Ravarana Lichtenstein recently published an article on one aspect of our Rebbe, his father-in-law, Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, on one aspect of his father-in-law's attitude towards religious Zionism. The article appeared in Alon Shvut, which is a publication for the graduates of Yeshivat Alon Shvut, where Ravarana is the Rosh Yeshiva, and the issue was dated Tishrei Tashsag, in other words, Tishrei of 2002-2003, and it's the 17th volume of the Alon Shvut, 17th volume that has been issued. And in this article, Rabaran begins very interestingly by telling us that someone just handed him an article published in America, a critique of one of the volumes that has come out on the Rav. And the critique is called Remaking, I'll say, Rabbi Soloveitchik in his own image. I can't say Remaking Soloveitchik, it hurts my vocal cords. But Remaking Rabbi Soloveitchik in his own image. And the person who gave this article, Baruch Lichtenstein, showed him how in this volume, the person who is interpreting the Rav is interpreting him in his own image. And Rav Aaron says very insightfully that reading this critique and in general with all that has been said about the Rav, we notice two factors. One, that the Rav is such a seminal, important personality for us in the Torah world that everyone would like to have the Rav in his camp. So that each individual, wherever his hashkafa leads him, attempts to remake Rabbi Soloveitchik in his own image. So this is one point, a point that's well taken. A second point that Rabaran makes, that the fact that so many different people can paint the Rav differently shows us how difficult, how sophisticated, perhaps at times contradictory, the Rav's outlook and hashkafa and philosophic thrust has been over the generations. So you see, from both point of views, it's a compliment to the Rav. On one hand, everyone would like us to believe that the Rav gives a stamp of approval on their outlook. Concomitantly, the Rav was so multifaceted. There were so many layers, so many different viewpoints that he expressed that at times, if we're not big enough to see the entire picture, so we see only part of what the Rav has said, and we take that as a total expression of the Rav's gestalt or the Rav's hashkafa. Either way, it's a compliment to the Rav and his multifacetedness, his depth, the man who was our Rebbe, and in the rabbinic aphorism, Shichmo Lamala Makola Am, he certainly was heads and shoulders above all of us. Now, I would like to devote this opening lecture, which I'm giving in the Gris Kollel in Jerusalem, to the Rav's attitude towards Zionism and the State of Israel. And obviously, I'm going to try not to make the mistake of others and not to remake the Rav in my image or in your image, but to try to understand the Rav as he really understood himself. I do not believe there's any topic more difficult to deal with, because here we're dealing with the Rav and Zionism, the modern state of Israel, and there is absolutely contradiction in the Rav's lifestyle and his teachings from different periods, and we have to relate to it. But I'd like to begin today with understanding the historic sociological background into which the Rav was born and to which the Rav, in which the Rav was reared and raised and nurtured. When it comes to Zionism and all that has happened in the last 100, 150 years, perhaps 200 years, all that has happened, the Holocaust, the birth of the State of Israel, the ingathering of the exiles, we have to turn to a Rambam. And the words of the Rambam, in my humble opinion, have to guide us in our entire approach to Zionism and all that has happened. If someone were to ask you what the halacha is on any specific topic, it's not too difficult to give a definitive answer. We have the sources, you work them out, and you give an answer. If someone were to ask you on a philosophic topic, it could very well be you'll find the machlokes rishonim, such as Anochi Hashem Elokecha, do you count it among the Tayak Mitzvah, the Rambam, the Ramban, but willy-nilly, you'll be able to give a learned answer. And even if you can't give a definitive answer, you'll be able to say, well, this is an argument between these Rishonim or between the Kuzari and this and Ravenu Sajagon. You'll be able to at least come to some definitive outline of the question at hand. If someone were to ask you 200, 300 years ago, 100 years ago, and even at this point, describe for us in detail Chazal's approach to redemption and to the return to the state of Israel, to the return to Eretz Yisrael, could you give a definitive answer? Where would you begin? You would open up Shas, you would look into the Gemara at the end of Ketuvot, you would look into the Perek Chelek, the 10th Perek of Sanhedrin, where there's so much material. You would look in Masechet Shabbat, the Maimari Chazal, and you'll find Medrashim. And when you study all this material, you will still not be able to give a definitive answer because the contradictions are on every point, on every concept. What does redemption mean? Will it be a redemption that will be abnormal, that will be miraculous? Or will it be a redemption that will go in a normal fashion? When will Tchiyat HaMetim be? What exactly does it mean, Eliyahu Navi coming before Mashiach Tzidkenu? And every question you touch upon, you will not be able to derive at a definitive answer, or even be able to say, well, it's machloket between two specific Rishonim. This is so true that the Rambam is posek lahalacha in Hilchot Melachim, Perek Yud Bed, Halacha Bet, and I cite the Rambam, V'chaleilu ha-davarim ki yotzebekhem lo yeda adam heich yiyu ad sheyihiyu. The Rambam here is talking about redemption and coming back to Eretz Yisrael and the ultimate days of Mashiach Tzidkenu, and the Rambam paskins lahalacha that we will never know how this will happen until it actually happens. Shedavarim stumen heim yetzal hanaviyim. He says the prophets do not elaborate. There are many prophecies, but nothing is absolutely clear. More than that, gam chachamim ein lehem kabbalah devarim eilu ela lefi hechrech hapsukim ulefikach yesh lehem machlok b'devarim eilu. And even the sages have so many different opinions because they're trying to interpret the sentences, and they reach no definitive conclusion. And the Rambam goes so far as to say that we shouldn't be overly involved in learning about this and trying to define it. When we live it, we'll understand it. And then he quotes the Gemara, and this is a very powerful Gemara. He quotes the Gemara from Sanhedrin, V'chein lo yachshu hakitzim. People should not be involved in trying to describe the end of days. Amru Chachamim, our sages said, Tipach Tapuach Daitan Shel Mechashvei Kitzin. Tapuach Daitan? May they lose their minds. Anyone who gets involved in telling you how the redemption is going to be, may they lose their minds. Tipach Rucham. That's one of the Gersot Nigamah. The Rambam calls it Tipach Daitan. But no matter which way the proper textual reading is, it is a very strong statement, a very strong malediction. Tipach Daitan, Tipach Ruchan, Shemechashvei Kitzin, Eliyachakeh, V'yamin Bechlal Hadavah, K'moshe Biyanu. And the Rambam says, we have to wait, we have to believe, we believe Mashiach Tzidkenu, we believe in the return to Eretz Yisrael, we believe in Olam Haba, but the belief has to be a general belief. We cannot cross the T's and dot the I's in spelling it out. Only when we reach it and we live it, will we understand it, will we experience it. And I think that this Rambam is extremely powerful and extremely in place. If we're discussing the Rav and his attitude towards the state of Israel, time and again, we cannot forget this Rambam. I think, as I will show in the course of my lectures, it plays a basic and vital role in the Rav's Weltanschauung, or his unfolding Weltanschauung, vis-a-vis what happened in the 20th century. Now, to understand the Rav and his family, we have to go back in history. And we have to go back to Moses Mendelssohn. All of you are aware that until about the mid-1700s, the Jews basically lived in a ghetto. Whether we chose to live in a ghetto or were forced to live in a ghetto, whether the ghetto was an ideal or, as Rav Samson Foyle Hirsch has stated so many times and wrote in the 19 letters and elsewhere, that the ghetto was basically a tragedy for the Jewish people. It removed us from our total existence of having Torah and civilization. We lived in a ghetto, and these are the facts. Pro or con, good or bad, but the reality was we lived in the ghetto. And then, of course, the world had gone through major changes. The whole Renaissance, the revolution against the Catholic Church, and even within the Catholic Church, the development of Protestantism, it gave us a world that became more man-centered than God-centered. The encyclopedist, all that was developing intellectually in France, which was then the bastion of advanced human thinking, Western civilization evolves from what happens in France in the 18th century. And of course, if the stress is on man, then a Jew is also a man, also a woman, also a human being, also a person. And why do we have the Jew in the ghetto? The Jew is no different than a non-Jew, than a Catholic, than a Protestant. And intelligent Gentiles started to think with this understanding that it's time to allow the Jew out of the ghetto. Moses Mendelssohn, of course, becomes the first Jew to leave the ghetto. Moses Mendelssohn, known by many names, Moshe ben Menachem or Moshe Dessau, from where he was born. Moshe Mendelssohn was a great-grandson of the Ramah. He's named after his great-grandfather, Reb Moshe Rissalis, and this is Reb Moshe Mendelssohn. And Moshe Mendelssohn, who corresponded with Reb Yaakov Emden, became very famous as a philosopher. He won a contest where he came in ahead of Lessing, taking first prize on a contest in Germany on a metaphysical topic. His German people, in retrospect, philosophers have told me that when you read Lessing's essay and Mendelssohn's essay, you can conclude today that Lessing was more profound. But Mendelssohn's German was so magnificent that that swayed the jury beyond the philosophic contents was the beauty of the way he wrote German. And Mendelssohn comes out of the ghetto, and he struggles, of course. He remains a Torah Jew. We have letters of his to Lessing, to others, where he says, I must put my pen down. The Sabbath is approaching. We Jews cannot write on Shabbat. One time Lessing visits Berlin or visits Moshe Mendelssohn's area, and he invites him to visit him on Shabbat. He says, I can't visit you because I can't travel, but you can come to visit me. And Mendelssohn, of course, was born a good Jew, a Talmud Chacham, and died a good Jew. However, half of his surviving children, after his death, converted away from Judaism. I believe we can say authoritatively that only one grandchild died Jewish. I don't believe there was a great-grandchild who already was buried in a Jewish cemetery. And all of you know that coming out of the ghetto led to massive assimilation, a total, complete breakdown in Western Europe, ultimately not just assimilation, but Heinrich Heine and others, in order to achieve positions of prominence, professorships, converted away from Judaism. And in Western Europe, the Enlightenment, the Haskalah, generally resulted in assimilation and intermarriage, and extremely tragic results for the continuity of the Jewish people. Why did this happen? This is a question that has to be discussed at a different time. But on the simplest level, the answer is it was too fast and too soon. It's like a person going through a cave where there's no light, and suddenly he comes to a crevice, and from a dark cave, he enters the Judean desert, Midbar Yehuda, and you all know how much light there is in the sun, and he's blinded. And it takes a while for the pupils to adjust, but you're blinded. The Jew living in the ghetto had a certain lifestyle. His religion, his commitment was predicated upon a certain lifestyle, a certain rhythm of life. Suddenly he comes out of the ghetto and the non-Jewish world is willing to accept him. All the doors are open and he's blinded. And while he's blinded, he makes tragic mistakes. And among them, he puts being accepted into German culture, Western culture, the more sophisticated culture, as he sees it at that moment in time. And he makes that his prime achievement. And of course, the children already have less of Judaism, the grandchildren even less. And ultimately, you reach a decision, why should I be a Jew? Or 50 years later, you have the first Reformed temple. In other words, let me remain a Jew. You don't want to rush. You're not that blinded. But I can't be like I was in the ghetto. So you become Reformed, but a generation or two later, why should I be Reformed? Ultimately, that cannot hold you Jewish, and the assimilation and the marriage take place. That was in Western Europe. A classic example of what ultimately happens is Napoleon's Sanhedrin. Napoleon's Sanhedrin is one of the most fascinating moments in modern Jewish history. And it's a moment that I would say becomes a drop of prophecy for all that's going to happen afterwards. Because Napoleon was not anti-Semitic. If anything, our evidence today indicates, and what we know about Napoleon and the Holy Land and his visit here on the way down to the Nile, to the Battle of the Nile, and Givat HaTzafatit, the French Railway, supposedly stood on the mountain there and saw the Temple Mount. They told him this was once the Beis HaMikdash, and he actually promised the Jews that if you aid me and help me, I will help you rebuild the third Beis HaMikdash. Napoleon was not anti-Semitic, and he respected the Jews. And he actually came up with this idea, whether it was his original idea, he was a very brilliant person, Napoleon, or it was his advisors. But imagine to allow the Jews to convene a Sanhedrin, two-thirds of the members being great rabbis, and one-third being the lay leaders. And he presented them 12 questions and asked them for authoritative answers. If you look at the questions, you'll see that the gist of what he was trying to accomplish, the gist of the questions, but the gist that he was leading to was that the Jews should declare, the rabbis should declare, we're out of the ghetto, we now have to live as good French citizens, we have to love our French neighbors, we have to serve in the army, we have to be an integral part of the French people, of the Jewish faith. And that's what Napoleon wanted, of course. Once you became a French citizen, and once you became a German citizen, and once you became an integral part of society around you, if you were not anchored by a deep commitment to Torah and Yirat Shemayim, so within a year, within a generation or two, it evaporated. But that was the ultimate development in Western Europe. Haskalah, citizenship, member of the big world beyond the ghetto, ultimately assimilation into marriage. Eastern Europe, you see, today we have a global village. Today we all see the same television, we all have the same channels. It's a global village. 200 years ago, it wasn't a global village yet, but nevertheless, it wasn't the Middle Ages. Ideas traversed across borders. What happened in Western Europe, slowly but surely, started traveling, came into Poland, came into Lithuania, the Ukraine, White Russia, Russia, all the countries beyond. It took 50 years, 75 years. It didn't happen overnight. There was no instant communication, but people traveled back and forth, businessmen, scholars, rabbanim, and little by little they brought back these ideas of enlightenment, and Jews were stepping out of the ghetto. Of course, in Russia, there was always a love and hate relationship between the Tsar and the Jews. Some Tsars were more liberal, other Tsars were not liberal at all. The Pale of Settlement, in the Pale, outside the Pale, there was always give and take between the Jewish citizens of the great Tsarist Empire and the Tsar's benevolence to them, or at times, it was not benevolence. What's fascinating is that the Haskalah, the enlightenment that reaches Eastern Europe, develops in a different format than Western Europe. Western Europe, they were overwhelmed, it happened quickly, assimilated, intermarried. Eastern Europe, which perhaps to begin with was more deeply religious and more deeply learned, and its roots were much deeper than the German Jew. There may be some truth to this. But it could also be that in Eastern Europe they saw the results. And they saw the results of enlightenment in Western Europe and how it totally broke down commitment to Judaism. And there was resolve and resolution, whether it was conscious or subconscious, in Eastern Europe, this will not happen here. And the Enlightenment, very interestingly, led to a revival of Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, and from that revival of Hebrew, the Enlightenment to a great degree led to Zionism. You see, what did Enlightenment mean in Eastern Europe? You saw beyond the ghetto. You saw beyond the pale of settlement. You saw what was happening with the non-Jew. So number one, on a religious level, most of the Maskilim were very opposed to the Hasidim in particular. You know that many novels were written against the Hasidim, many polemical articles written against the Hasidim. They were opposed to a certain degree to what they saw as a certain fanaticism in the Torah world in general. But specifically, there was a head-on clash between the Hasidim. I don't have to tell you to the outside onlooker who sees the Hasidic world with the adoration of the Rebbe, with the Shirayim. Have you ever seen Shirayim? Where Hasidim push and shove to get a drop of the bread that the Rebbe ate from the same challah, the same loaf. Of course, to the Haskalah mind, he looked at this and said, this is primitive, this cannot be, how can we leave the ghetto, we can't. And also the dress. Those of you that have studied about the history of the Jews in Eastern Europe, you know that the Jew dressed differently. He looked differently. He had an untrimmed beard. He had payas. He wore a kaftan. On Shabbos, he wore a shtreimel. The Hasidim davened with a gadol. No one could mistake a Hasid for a Russian. Everyone understood that a Hasid is not a Tatar, he's not a Kazakh, he's not a Russian, he's not a Lithuanian, he's not a Ukraine. He is a Hasid. Well, if you want to integrate into the big world, the Maskilim wanted the Jews to be educated, to dress in a more modern fashion, to give up unkept, untrimmed beards and long payas. All right, there was a lot of acrimony, a lot of acrimonious debate. There were poems that went back and forth, novels that were written. But on the other hand, the Maskilim wrote in biblical Hebrew, started developing a modern Hebrew, had a positive approach to the continuity of Jewish life, but they were outside the ghetto. Now, what does it mean when you're outside the ghetto? Outside the ghetto, what was happening in the 1800s? What characterizes the 19th century? The 19th century is characterized by self-determination, nationalism. All the countries are rebelling. They don't want to have Napoleon ruling all of Europe. They don't want to have the Tsar ruling all of Europe. Hungary wants to be independent. Austria wants to be independent. Poland wants to be independent. Countries are fighting, shedding blood time and again in the 19th century for their independence. Well, many of the Jews that are now out of the ghetto say if Poles can have Poland, if the Hungarians can have Hungary, why can't we have Eretz Yisrael? And there's a confluence here of two different ideas. One concept from within Jewish existence. Jewish existence, three times a day when a Jew davened, v'techezener einenu b'shuvacha l'tzion b'rachamim, Yerushalayim yircha b'rachamim tashuv. When a Jew benched, uvenei Yerushalayim rachem, everything in benching centers around the land of Israel. A good deal of our davening centers around the land of Israel. The two holiest moments of the year, certainly from an emotional point of view. The Rebbe spoke about this many times, that his life was shaped by Seder night and Yom Kippur. How do we end the Seder? L'shana haba v'Yerushalayim.
How do we end Yom Kippur? L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. So there's the healthy, intrinsic Jewish longing, Torah longing. We have to return to Eretz Yisrael. But now, for the first time, there's a confluence, because it's not just the Jewish longing. You can also express it in secular terms. Poles have Poland, Austrians have Austria, the Germans have Germany, the Italians have Italy. How many battles were fought in Italy? We Jews are no different. We are an indigenous people with an indigenous language, with an indigenous culture, and we want Eretz Yisrael. I obviously don't have to add that the anti-Semitism and the pogroms certainly aided in the development of the nascent Zionist movement. You see, when the Jew left the ghetto, they really believed, now that we'll take off our beards, we'll take off our payas, we'll take off our black clothes, we'll be educated, we'll be doctors and dentists and lawyers and accountants and business people, and we'll have major stores, and then we'll win Nobel Prizes, all that we dream about. Jews honestly believe anti-Semitism will end. Why is there anti-Semitism? Because we're different. Once we're no longer different, fine, we'll be Germans of the Jewish faith, just as they're Germans of the Catholic faith, the Lutheran faith, etc., French people of various faiths. But shockingly enough, even though they came out of the ghetto, even though they integrated, be it in Western Europe or be it in Eastern Europe, anti-Semitism remained, and particularly in Eastern Europe, time after time were there pogroms where the Jews were reminded, unfortunately, while burying their dead, as much as you try to become part of the greater world around you, there's still going to be a core element that will hate you, that will despise you, that will kill you, that will maim you. And this, of course, also aided in the Zionist dream, so that you have a confluence of the ancient, time-honored, hallowed Torah desire, Shivat Zion, and in addition, the atmosphere around us is willing to understand the concept of self-determination of nationalism, and the Jew is, unfortunately, cannot assimilate totally, because the pogroms and the anti-Semitism remind him, you are a Jew and you're an indigenous people, and you better get your own homeland where there will not be anti-Semites. Now, this background creates tremendous tension and upheaval in the yeshiva world in the 1800s. When we speak about Voloshin, when we speak about Mir, when we speak about the great yeshiva that existed at that time, at times we attempt, or even without intention, it's not that we attempt, but just logically, naturally, we accept the fact, Kulam Kadoshim, Kulam Tahorim, that everyone who studied in the yeshiva was a top yeshiva student, was a tremendous Yirei Shamayim, that no one questioned, everyone accepted. We accept this sort of as being a fact. In reality, the yeshivot were not in isolated towers. They were interwoven and interconnected with society. And within the yeshivot, there was tremendous tension. The machloket we referred to earlier in the Rambam, how the Rambam says, Tipach Daitam, was, there's a gister in the Gemara, Tipach Rucham Shamach HaShvei Kitzin. This machloket went on in the yeshivot. Can we be part of the Zionist reawakening? Can't we be part of the Zionist reawakening? And remember, the machloket is not simple, because it is a problem or a quagmire, an enigma that's with us until today, 150 years later. Who were the leaders of the Zionist movement? By and large, they were not religious. Although historically we have every right to say that it was great rabbis who were the first to articulate the Zionist dream, Reb Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, Shivat Zion. Before him, Rabbi Huldar Alkalai, after Reb Shmuel Molava. But yet, all of you know that when we talk in terms of Zionism, all the credit goes to Theodor Herzl. And who was Theodor Herzl? Theodor Herzl was a totally assimilated Hungarian Jew. He came, of course, grandparents were proper Jews. His parents already were what we would call conservative Jews, and he was very successful. Correspondent for the Freie Neue Presse, the Vienna Freie Neue Presse. He was a correspondent. He wrote. And he travels to France to attend the Dreyfus trial. And here this man, happily married with children, without a care in the world, assimilated, and you know, a Jew by name, but a minimum of observance. And suddenly he hears the master shouting, "Death to the Jews." And in a moment, as we have spoken about so many times, when we talk about Shuvah, and we talk about the Rav's Torah on Shuvah, the Rav has that entire essay, which was a Shuvah Drasha on Al HaTshuvah, how in a moment your life can change, like the Rav describes Franz Rosenzweig, how he was ready to convert away from Judaism, and he walked into a shtibbel in Germany of Aus Juden, one Yom Kippur, just to see what it was like. He walked in ready to convert away from Judaism and came out with a determination to become a Torah Jew. So look what happened to Herzl. He was attending the trial. He's going to report for the paper. And he walks in, Theodor Herzl, and he comes out, Binyamin Zev Herzl, returning to his people, engendering the whole idea of Zionism, putting it on the map in a practical, mundane fashion. But yet, look what happens with Herzl. On one hand, his image, the man conquers the masses of Eastern Europe. There practically wasn't a Jewish home that did not have Herzl's picture on the wall, his long beard, his patriarchal look. But the religious Jews, how do we relate to it? How do we deal with it? Here's a man, Mechallel Shabbos, from no background, assimilated, speaks in terms of Zionism. What type of Zionism did he understand? This was not a Zionism, Kimitzion, Teitzei Torah, Udava Hashem, Yerushalayim. This was not a Zionism rooted in all that is dear and precious to us, not a Zionism that comes from the Brit Bein Habatarim, the covenant with Avram Avinu, the covenant with Bnei Yisrael. This is not a Zionism of sanctity and Kedushat Haaretz. This is a pragmatic Zionism. We are in trouble. As much as we assimilate, we're not accepted. There are pogroms. They hate us. Even in the most enlightened country in the world at that time, in France, look how the masses are yelling and shouting, "Death to the Jews." And how do we deal with Herzl? And this question of how to deal with Herzl is a question that haunts us until this very moment in time. Well over 100 years, it actually is on to 110 years since Herzl was converted to the cause of Zionism, we still have to struggle hashkafic-wise, philosophically, theologically, how does a Torah Jew relate to the man who brought about the miracle of the State of Israel? He engendered it, he started it, he gets the credit for it, and rightfully so. Binyamin Zev Herzl. Now, the Rav's forebears, talk in terms of the Rav, you talk in terms of the Lashon. As you all know, the Rav is a direct descendant of Rav Chaim Volozhin, and in my work on the Rav, I have the Yichus charts where you see it before your eyes. Volozhin belonged to his family. Lithuanian yeshivat were family institutions. They were not public trusts, but families established yeshivat, and you had to be the son of the Rosh Yeshiva or the son-in-law of the Rosh Yeshiva in order to continue to be a Magid Shir, to be a Rosh Yeshiva in the yeshiva. Lithuania produced Volozhin. Volozhin, a little shtetl not far from Vilna. Not far from Vilna. I understand by car you can travel it in about 35 minutes, and if there'd be a better road, people tell me it would be no further than Yerushalayim to perhaps Efrat or a little bit beyond Efrat, which is no more than a 15-20 minute journey. And a little shtetl, a little backwater town, and that's where Rav Chaim Volozhin founded Talmud Mufak of the Vilna Gaon, great-great-great-grandfather Rav Yosef Tov Halevi Soloveitchik. That's where he founded the Volozhin Yeshiva. And it became the most famous yeshiva in modern times. It functioned for on to 90 years until it was forcibly closed down by the Russian government for its refusal to introduce Russification, which translated on a practical level a Russian outlook, Russian studies, secular studies, Russian culture, language, etc. Now, who was the most famous Rosh Yeshiva during the heart of the Russian's existence? Of course, it was Rav Soloveitchik's great-grandfather, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, known as the Netziv of the Lushan, the man who Rav Soloveitchik, who the Rav always referred to as Rav Heschel Leib. Rebbe, whenever I say Rebbe, I mean my Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav. Rebbe in Shir always referred to the Netziv as Rav Heschel Leib. When I was a youngster, went into the Rav Shir, I don't know, I was about 18 years old, I didn't know who Rav Heschel Leib was. It took me a while until I comprehended that Rav Heschel Leib was the Yiddish way to say Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. So here you have one dominant figure in Volozhin, the Rosh Yeshiva. And the Netziv was already a person who read Haskalah literature. He was open to Haskalah literature. At times he agreed, at times he disagreed. He debated with them, but he was well aware of the new currents that were developing. He also was a supporter of the nascent Zionist movement, the precursor of the Zionist movement, or the runner of the Zionist movement, Chibat Zion, Chovevei Zion. The Netziv was a supporter in the full sense of the word. If you want to understand the Netziv better, you just refer to his Talmud Mufak. Who was the Talmud Mufak of the Netziv of Volozhin? Rabbi Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. Rabbi Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, here you're talking about a Volozhiner, a first-rate Talmud Chacham, a man born and bred in the Volozhin atmosphere, later to become Panovich Yerov, a man to dream the dream of redemption, a man who resembled Rav Cook in his multifacetedness, who resembled the Netziv. The Rav Cook resembled the Netziv in his multifacetedness. Who was the Netziv? The Netziv of Volozhin, you have a great Rosh Yeshiva, Merome Sadeh, Chidushim on Shas. He was a great Rav, a Posek, the Meshev Dava. He was a homiletic, philosophic master of Parshat HaShavua, HaMeik Davar. He was so multitendinous in so many different areas. And you take a look at Rav Cook. Rav Cook was like his master, like his Rebbe, the first-rate Talmud Chacham, the Posek, the philosopher, the dreamer, the visionary. So you see that in Volozhin there was one trend, a trend that embraced Zionism, ultimately gives birth to religious Zionism, to Mizrahi, to Merkaz HaRav. We can say it's the great-grandfather of the entire development on the Israeli scene of Yeshivat Hezdah, of Mamlachti Dati Torani, of the Ulpanat for Girls, of the Yeshuvim in Yehuda V'Shomron. Who was the founder of the first B'nai Akiva Yeshiva here, Rav Moshe Tzvi Neri, a Kfar HaRoeh? He came from a Lashon family. His father, the family name was Menken, I believe. His father was a first-rate Talmud Chacham, was from the old Volozhin. So you see a direct line from the Netziv in Volozhin, Zionism. But this was only one part. This is only one aspect. Remember what I said at the start of this series of lectures. We do not want to remake Rabbi Soloveitchik in our image. We have to see the total picture. There was another part of Volozhin. And I would say the second part of Volozhin had more influence on Rav Soloveitchik than this aspect. Because the Rav had other relatives in Volozhin. The Netziv of Volozhin had a daughter. His daughter married Reb Rafal Shapiro. Reb Rafal Shapiro became Volozhin of Rosh Yeshiva. Now, Reb Rafal Shapiro was a fascinating individual whose entire life was just learning and being Mechadesh and saying a Shia. He was not involved beyond, to use our idiom, the classroom. The famous story about the Rafal Shapiro, which says it all, is that he was sitting in the Voloshin Beis Medrash, and his wife or his daughter appeared at the door, and they sent a messenger in, tell Reb Rafal to get ready. He's marrying off a daughter in a half hour's time. He has to come home to get dressed and get ready for the wedding. And they say Reb Rafal Shapiro got up and he turned to his students and he said, he said, Sa Gidl Banim, look at the pain in raising children that I have to lose a half hour and then a few hours at the wedding. My daughter is getting married and this is Sa Gidl Banim. So I don't have to tell you, it's wife took care of the shidduch, the family took care of all the arrangements, and a half hour before they had to go to chuppah, they just had to remind him to come home and change into his Shabbos bekasha. So look what we see from this. Reb Rafal was not involved beyond the proverbial dalar amot shel halacha. But Reb Rafal had a son-in-law. Who is the Netziv's grandson-in-law, Reb Rafal's son-in-law, Gadol mi Rabban Shmo, perhaps greater than those who came before him, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Reb Chaim later Reb Chaim Briska, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the son of Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, Briska Rav. This is the famous Soloveitchik family, direct descendants from Reb Chaim Voloshin, Reb Yitzchak Voloshin, the Netziv, Reb Rafal. What families here? What intermarriage? Imagine Reb Yosef Dov Halevi, and they were related on both sides. They descend from Reb Chaim. The Netziv is a son-in-law, and from Reb Chaim Voloshin, the Netziv is a son-in-law, and Reb Chaim is a direct descendant. Look at the families. They intermarry. Reb Chaim, the son of Reb Yosef Dov of Brisk, the Beit Halevi, marries the daughter of Reb Fol Shapiro, the granddaughter of Reb Heschel Leib, or the Netziv. And Reb Chaim becomes the dominant figure on the Voloshin scene. Already in his early 20s, people turned to him. He engendered this whole new approach to Torah, this whole new approach to learning, his whole new approach to analysis. Reb Chaim's Derech, the Rambam, the language he used, the Chepsa, the Gavra, Reb Chaim revolutionizes Talmudic approach, rabbinic studies. This is Reb Chaim. He has followers. And already as a youngster, a tremendous crowd of Talmidei Chachamim, a first-rate Iluyim, prodigies gather around him. Later in Brisk, after Voloshin is closed down and his father dies a year later, Reb Chaim becomes Brisk Rav. And there in Brisk, from all the yeshivot in Europe, it's like the finishing school for the finest Talmidei Chachamim from Mir, from Radin. You have to come to Reb Chaim in Brisk. From Slabodka, they come to Reb Chaim, they're pulled to Reb Chaim to master his derech, to be in his presence. This is the great Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. So you see, my Rebbe has one great-great-grandfather, the Netziv, but he has another grandfather, Reb Chaim, another grandfather, the great-grandfather, the Beit Halevi. Now, what was their attitude towards Zionism? Their attitude was totally and absolutely opposed. They saw Zionism as an offshoot of Haskalah, as an offshoot of enlightenment. They saw Zionism ultimately as a rebellion. They saw Zionism as trying to coerce God's hands, which we're not allowed to do. You're all familiar with the Gemara at the end of Ketuvah, that we cannot force the redemption, we cannot go up on the wall. They saw Zionism as leading to assimilation. It would be a secular nationalism. This is not a Torah nationalism. This is a secular nationalism. They saw Zionism in terms that they could not accept it. They could not make peace with it, but more than that, they actively opposed it. They saw Zionism as a development that would break down the barriers and open the gates to assimilation and take the Jew away from Torah. Now, some stories or anecdotes illustrate this very beautifully. These anecdotes have been told and basically in some versions, but you can, being alive as long as I have and having heard some of these stories 40, 50 years ago, I have a feeling that these stories are absolutely true, even if perhaps there are various versions, but the heart of the story is true, and it tells us everything. When Herzl died, early 1900s, was like a shockwave that went through Eastern Europe. Herzl was idolized, and the average Jew was in mourning. Young man, Herzl was 44 years of age. I believe he was born in 1860, died in 1904, heart attack. The Jews were shocked. They were in trauma. And in Brisk, Reb Chaim gave the word, no shul is... Reb Chaim gave the order, no shul is allowed to eulogize Herzl. Absolutely forbidden. Forbidden. No shul. Chas v'chalila. Nope. Menachem Begin's father, later the prime minister of Israel, we're talking about his father, was in a state of shock. He's a frum Jew, but he was a Zionist. What? You're not going to eulogize Theodor Herzl in Brisk? He went and on the spot, organized the new shul, and in the new shul, they eulogized Theodor Herzl. And when people complained, the anti-Zionists complained, how dare you act in this fashion? How dare you contravene and contradict the words and the order of Moreinu v'Rabbeinu Reb Chaim Soloveitchik Brisk Rav? How dare you? Who gave you permission? Menachem Begin's father, look at them. I should contradict the words of the Mura Diatra? I should go against Reb Chaim Soloveitchik? Chas v'chalila, he said that you're not allowed to eulogize Theodor Herzl in any shul in Brisk. This shul was built after he said it. The prohibition only applied to the shuls that existed when he gave the edict. I organized a new shul. In this new shul, the edict doesn't apply. It wasn't around when the rabbi issued his pronouncement. And that shul was known as the Herzl shul until the Hitler period. So this gives you a little bit of insight into Reb Chaim, but more. I recount in the Rav 1701, and this is a story I heard already in Lakewater, but I heard various versions, but I retell it. I was not there when the Rav told the story to his class, but Rabbi Michal Shurkin, who studied with the Rav, I believe, longer than any other Talmud. I think it's something like 18 years that Rabbi Michal Shurkin studied with the Rav at YU. I have to stress at YU, not in Boston, but at YU, even though in his writings he refers to the Rav as Av Beit Din of Boston, and somehow YU is not mentioned. But Rabbi Michal Shurkin studied with the Rav in Yeshivas Pischochan, and he claims, in his notes, he has it written the way the Rav told the story, and I believe Rabbi Michal Shurkin's reliable, and I published the story for posterity the way Rabbi Michal's version, because I heard it slightly differently, but the stories, the gist of it is exactly the same. And the story is very simple, that in Volozhin, there was a secret society of Zionism, a clandestine group that later crystallized into the Mizrahi, and these were some of the top students studying in Volozhin, Gedolei Yisrael. And Reb Chaim was furious, Zionist. He got hold of one of the individuals who he knew what was going on. Goin Shebegoinim, Reb Menachem Krakowski, that's the name Michal Shurkin says. The Rav said that was later the Rav's uncle. He married the Rav's mother's sister. He married Badana. Badana Feinstein was the sister of Pesha Feinstein. He later becomes the Rav's uncle, and you know him as the author of the Avodat HaMelech, which is one of the most unique rabbinic works of the 20th century. It's an absolute synthesis between Volozhin approach and a feeling for scientific knowledge, for a scientific approach, for variant readings and understanding. You have to get a proper text. It's a magnificent synthesis. Unfortunately, we only have the Avodat HaMelech on the early sections of the Rambam. The bulk of the manuscript was lost during the Holocaust. It was a magnificent manuscript, and they didn't have the money to publish more than the first part. He died young, Reb Menachem Krakowski, and the widow and everyone perished during the Holocaust. The manuscript was gone. So Reb Chaim came to Reb Menachem Krakowski and said, reveal to me Who are the Bachrim that are studying, that are Zionists, that are meeting and talking Zionism? I will rebuke them, I'll reprimand them, probably throw them out of the yeshiva, they're up because of them. And Rabbi Menachem Krakowski answered, Rabbi Chaim said, Rebbe, I can't reveal it to you. I took an oath not to reveal it. And Rabbi Chaim shot back at him, the oath is not binding, and he quoted the Mishnah in Shvuot, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Chet, 3:8 in Shvuot, Nishba Levatel Ata Mitzvah, that if you take an oath to nullify or abrogate a mitzvah, the oath is not binding. How can you take an oath to abrogate a mitzvah? You took an oath not to reveal who the Zionists are? Reveal those names immediately to me, because this is an oath to abrogate and negate the Torah. So you see, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was anti-Zionist with a capital A. Not only anti-Zionist, when talk began about Agudat Yisrael, and here I have to give a little background. Not many in our generation already know how Agudat Yisrael developed. Before the 1900s, most Jews, 90%, 95%, would not be Mechalel Shabbos per Parhesia. With the advent of modernity, and particularly with World War I, there's the tremendous breakdown in Jewish life. Socialism, anarchism, ultimately Bolshevikism, communism. I'm not even talking about now assimilation and intermarriage, but I'm talking in Eastern Europe. All these isms took over. And Chilul Shabbos Lo Aleinu became more and more the norm. We Torah Jews have one attribute. We have no unity. We fight with each other. What I would like to be Melamed Zchut. I don't want to tell over the joke. They're saying the name of Professor Saul Lieberman, that someone asked him, are there any jokes in the Talmud? And Professor Lieberman said, yes, Chazal have a sense of humor if they could say, Talmidei Chachamim, Ma Ben Shalom B'Yolam, that scholars create peace in the world. I would like to be Melamed Zchut. You know why we fight? Because Torah is so precious to us that dotting every I and crossing every T becomes major for us. And perhaps this is why we have so many differences of opinion. It's precious. Something precious you take good care of. If you have, for the sake of argument, an autograph of someone famous, a letter from someone famous, a tshuva from Rav Moshe Feinstein, believe me, you are going to take good care of that tshuva. You're not going to let it vulgar, if I may use the ancient Yiddish. You're not going to just let it lie there. You're going to put it into plastic. You're going to take care of it. You're going to see that dust doesn't get on top of it. Yiddishkeit is precious to us. So we stand on everything that we consider part of Torah as we understand it. Now, by the dawn of the 20th century, by the dawn of the 1900s, there was tremendous splits within the Torah world. All of you know, Hasidus conquered Poland and beyond. Talk about Poland, you're talking in terms of Gur and the Rizhina dynasties. Even in Lithuania already, you have in White Russia, Lubavitch. Lithuania, you already have Karl and Stalin. You have dynasties. And Hasidus is now major and embraces perhaps well onto 1 million Jews. You have the Lithuanian world, the Valencian world, the Mira world, the Briska world, the Radin world. This world did not accept Hasidus so easily. Hasidim daven differently, have different minhagim, aren't makpidin zmanei tefillah. Hasidim rebbeim take 12 challahs Friday night, shiftei Yisrael. They're innovators. There was a lot of tension, a lot of opposition. I don't have to tell you, if a Hasidic boy got engaged to a Litvisha girl or vice versa, at times the families were angry to use the expression, they sat shiva. I don't have to tell you the fights that went on among Hasidim. You take the Sanzeva versus the Ruzhina. It practically reached Shvichat Amim. No Hungarian Hasid would eat from a Polish Sheikhid who was from the Ruzhina dynasty. And this is within the Litvisha world, within the Hasidisha world, and the Litvisha versus the Hasidisha. And then you take the German Orthodox world. The Litvisha looked at the Germans, the Hasidim looked at the Germans, the Litvisha looked, they don't know how to learn, they're ignoramuses. And the Hasidim looked, this Jew in modern clothes with a trim little Van Dyke beard, you mean to tell me this is an observant Jew? And the Machloket Sakat L'Shamayim went all the way to heaven, back and forth and back. But by the early 1900s, some of the leaders understood that we Orthodox Jews can't go on being divided. A house divided will not survive in a world where Chilul Shabbos is becoming the norm. In unity, there is strength. And people started to talk right about 1910, we have to organize, we have to get together. And preliminary meetings were held to form an organization that would unite all Orthodox Jews to be called Agudat Yisrael, as we say in the Piyut and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, V'yasru Kulam Aguda Achat. All of you know that in any Aguda convention, this is the banner that embellishes the dais, and they spoke in terms, we have to have unity. Now, Agudat Yisrael did not begin functioning before 1919. World War I cut it off. There was supposed to be a major meeting to establish Agudat Yisrael in 1914. This is how Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook gets to Europe. Why did he leave Jaffa? He was chief rabbi of Jaffa. He traveled for the founding organizational worldwide meeting of Agudat Yisrael, but it never took place because World War I broke out and he was stranded in Europe. That's how he goes to Switzerland and he stays in the home of the chief rabbi of Basel for 2 years. Then he goes to London where he becomes the rav. There was a position, Machzikei Hadat, and after World War I, he returns a few years later to Eretz Yisrael as the chief rabbi of Jerusalem and very soon the chief rabbi of Palestine. Now, they're starting to talk preliminary meetings. Reb Chaim attends one of the preliminary meetings. He takes a look, and this the family told me. He sees the Yekeshe Rabbanim, the German Rabbanim, that you're going to make an Agudat Yisrael and bring in modernity and bring in German rabbis. Reb Chaim walked away. He never came back again. And he did not help in organizing Agudat Yisrael. If anything, he was opposed to Agudat Yisrael. He viewed it too as an innovation that we're changing, we're modernizing, where we're doing concepts, where we're executing ideas that our parents and our grandparents didn't dream about. And to a certain degree, this is Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who was the greatest Mechadesh. He was revolutionary. His approach to Talmud and learning and changing and innovating and the language he constructed, but the same Reb Chaim was extremely conservative with a small c when it came to Hashkafa and Torah lifestyle. I would say that when it came to Hashkafa and Torah lifestyle, he applied the aphorism of the Mishnah in Allah, the Chatam Sofer's famous rallying cry, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. What it means is that the new grain, the new crop, before you bring the Omer, you're not allowed to eat anything new, right or wrong, from the new grain. That in Eretz Yisrael, we're all makpid on it. Chutzlar, it's all right, it's machloket rishonim, but today more and more people are medakdek, are makpid, what we call yashan, chadash. And if you take it literally, not in the halachic sense, not figuratively what the Mishnah is talking about, but if you take, it's the last Mishnah, Perek Gimel Arla, but if you take it literally, Chadash, Asumen HaTorah, anything new is forbidden, any innovation is forbidden. And Reb Chaim actually viewed Agudat Yisrael as innovative. And after that initial meeting which he attended, and he saw already the German rabbis, they're going to have a role, they're going to have a part, they're going to lead us, they're going to be on an equal level with the Hasidic Rebbeim and the Litvish Gedolei Yisrael, Rashi Yeshiva, that was not for Reb Chaim. Interestingly enough, following World War I, Agudat Yisrael made a decision that if you believe in Zionism, you are not a good Jew. And anyone who believes in Zionism, even if you're a Shomer Shabbos, Makpit, and Kashrut, Karet Mishpacha, Kalaka Chamura, Medakdek in all the mitzvot, punctilious in your observance, meticulous. But if you believe in Zionism, you're not a good Jew, and you cannot be a member of Agudat Yisrael. So it's fascinating that what was originally intended as an all-embracing, orthodox Torah organization later becomes anti-Zionist, anti-Mizrahi, and it only embraces a certain element of those Orthodox Jews who renounce and declare Zionism beyond the boundary of proper belief and faith. Now, Rav Chaim, and this is also important to understand because I believe it plays a big role in the Rav's life on a psychological, theological, hashkafic level. There's a famous story about Rav Chaim. As they tried to engender Agudat Yisrael, they spoke in terms that Agudat Yisrael would be rabbi-oriented, meaning Rabbanim would make all decisions. And there would be a concept of Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah, the great Rabbanim of Lithuania, the great Hasidic Rabbanim, the great German Rabbanim, and their decisions would be binding. In other words, in order to achieve unity, you have to have a rabbinic council, and this rabbinic council will make decisions that will be binding upon every member. If I can use an analogy from our lectures in Halacha, it would be in the sense of a takana, that since you're a member of Agudat Yisrael, you accept the authority of what later becomes the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah, the World Council of Torah Sages, and what the World Council of Torah Sages says, or the edicts they engender or enact, becomes binding and obligatory upon every member of Agudat Yisrael. Fine. When this idea was first broached, was first approached, when it first came on the agenda, Reb Chaim was very opposed. And they asked Reb Chaim why. And here you come to a very insightful answer, an answer that makes you think more than once. They asked Reb Chaim why. What's wrong with this idea? The greatest Rabbanim, the greatest Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, the greatest Hasidic Rebbeim, the greatest German rabbis. What's wrong? Why can't we have this Council of Torah Sages, Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah? And Reb Chaim said as follows. Everyone rejoiced when electricity came to Brisk. He said, yes, overall, having electricity over kerosene lamps is a blessing. But there's one tremendous curse and problem with electricity. When lights go out, everyone is without light. When you had kerosene lamps, if you ran out of kerosene, you went to your neighbor and learned by their lamp or borrowed kerosene so you would have light by which to continue learning. Electricity is wonderful. But when there's a power failure, it's a lot worse than kerosene, because when you're using kerosene, there is no such concept as a power failure. Rav Chaim said, the idea of all the Rabbanim coming together and putting it to majority vote, he said, that idea goes against my understanding of Torah. This way we have Rabbanim in every area, every city, and each one gives a psak. Each one acts in accordance with his understanding. In each city you have your own kerosene. But if you're going to turn it into electricity and the rabbis make a joint mistake and there's a power failure, the entire Jewish people suffer. And Reb Chaim could not accept this concept of a council of Torah sages, of a Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. It was something that went against the very kernel of his brilliant, innovative mind, which was constantly thinking, and his reliance upon his own self-dignity and the rub of the shtut as the final word for that surrounding. And that's a fascinating point. So you see, with Reb Chaim, and let's be correct, the greatest influence on the Rav was Reb Chaim, not Reb Heschel Leib. He had many forebears. He descends, as you know, from the Feinsteins, from the Berlins. The Feinsteins, his mother. Mother was a Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein, a first cousin to his mother. Rebellia Feinstein, Rebellia Prujana, Prujana Rav, his grandfather. He descends from the Berlins, Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and the tremendous Yichus in the Berlin family. He descends from the Soloveitchik family. And of all his forebears, and he could quote Rebbe Fol Shapir, Rebbe Fol Voloshin, he certainly quoted Rebbe Heschel Leib many times. My Nelta Zayde with Fratmus, it's actually an Elta Zayde, if I'm correct. Check it out on the Yichus chart. But of all his forebears, no one had a greater influence on the Rav than Reb Chaim. I believe even my two volumes on the Rav, I once checked, I believe that Reb Chaim is quoted more than Reb Moshe, than his own father. Ad kidei kach, the influence of Reb Chaim. And this is Reb Chaim. Independence of thought. Not surrendering your mind. But this is Reb Chaim. You made a vow not to reveal who's studying in the group that later is going to become Mizrahi. This is Nishma Levatel et HaTorah. Ad kidei kach. That's how far Chaim is opposed. This is innovation. This is change. Who knows what it can lead to? Chaim was opposed. Okay. However, concomitantly, there was no greater lover of the land of Israel than Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Tell me, you go to yeshiva, you study in yeshiva, what did you study? Nezikin, Nashim. All the years I was a Talmud in yeshiva, I don't believe I ever studied within the yeshiva Masechet outside of Nezikin and Nashim. Kitten, Kiddushin, Baba Metzia, Baba Kama, Baba Batra, Sanhedrin, right or wrong? Who studied outside of Nezikin and Nashim? You can have Rashi Yeshiva who have said Shurim for 40, 50 years in Nezikin and Nashim. What do I know in Moed? But more than Moed. What do they know in Zrayim? What do they know in Kadshim? What do they know in Tarat? Where was Reb Chaim's strength? He was innovative in every field. But Reb Chaim came along and he had novellas and chidushim. Zrayim, Kadshim, Tarat. Resuscitated parts of Shas that we barely looked at before. And was Mechadesh. Now what do you mean, Zrayim? What do you mean, Kachim? What do you mean, Tarot? It's Eretz Yisrael. It's Bia Rishona, Bia Shni. I remember the Shurim I heard from the Rav. It revolutionized my thinking. The first coming to Israel. The second coming to Israel. Kibush, Chazakah. How does the land get its sanctity? Kiddush Rishona, Kiddush Lashayta, Kiddush Liyatid Lavo, Kiddush Shniya, Kiddush Lats Lavo, the Hom Machloket, the Rambam, the Ravid, Yerushalayim. What a world, what a world. Kabana, Tzvachim, Menachat. What kind of world is this? Taharat, Kalim, where do you go back? Eretz Yisrael, you relive. You're in the civilization of Chazal. Where? Alat Matakodesh. Where are Tumantara observed? Where's Kachim? Zrayim, Shviyat, Peya, Demai, Maisesheni, Maisani, Trumat, Machadesh, Reb Chaim. Matot Navzinin, Niyim, Rambam. What a love. What an Eretz Yisrael. So you see, on one level you can say Reb Chaim was opposed to Zionism. But Chas v'Chalila, Reb Chaim was never opposed to Eretz Yisrael. The Rav got a dual message from Reb Chaim. Practical Zionism, Herzl Zionism. Menachem Begin's father eulogizing Herzl. How do you eulogize a Jew like this? Didn't put on tefillin, didn't observe Shabbos. All right, it could be had he lived longer. Look at Nathan Birnbaum. Nathan Birnbaum was one of the early followers, totally assimilated Jew, became a follower of Herzl. Who coined the term Zionism? Who coined the term Zionism? Nathan Birnbaum coined the term Zionism. He has the copyright on it. But he lived a long life. By his middle age, he became an Agudist. From Zionism, he came to Judaism. From Judaism, he came to Agudat Yisrael, returned to his forebears. Great-great-grandchildren today, all religious, all from Nathan Birnbaum. Could be, people say it. Herzl lived longer. What began as this holy quest to save the Jews and led him to Zionism and took him away from assimilation, had he lived longer, he might have traversed the road that Nathan Birnbaum traveled on. But how do you eulogize him? Concomitantly, a love for its Yisrael, a love for its stones, a love for its atmosphere, a love for Kadshim, Tarot, Zrayim, Bia Rishona, Bia Shneir, all the Chidushim, all the insights. Reb Chaim,
This too, the Rav got. This is Rav Chaim. This is the Beit HaLevi. This is Volozhin. This is the Netziv. Regardless of any controversy or any dialogue regarding Zionism, but a Torah Jew, totally, absolutely committed to Eretz Yisrael. You look at Shas, at least half of Shas or more is devoted to topics that are solely related to Eretz Yisrael. Zrayim, Kodshim, Tarot, 100%. How much of Nezikin? Related. Nushim? Related. Moed? Related. The heart of our existence, Eretz Yisrael. So that there's a dual heritage, a dual culture, a dual environment, a dual message. There's a duality here. At times it may be contradictory on a practical level. But this is the atmosphere. This is where the Rav was raised. Okay. Let me go one step further before I conclude today. The Rav's formative years, and we all have to understand, we all go back to our childhood, but not much that happens when we're 2, 3, or 4 leaves a lasting influence. The Rav's formative years were spent in Haslovich, in White Russia. Those were the years, 1913 to 1920. The Rav was about 10 years old when he reaches Haslovich, and he's 17 years old when he leaves. These were the years, you know, from my biography of the Rav, and the Rav, you know, from the Rav's sister, Shulamit Meiselman's memoir, The Soloveitchik Heritage. You know that these were the formative years for the Rav. These were the years where he learned day and night with his father, where he mastered Shas and Poskim and Volozhin and Brisk and the entire family tradition. But these were the years, in addition, that he came in contact with the Hasidic world. Haslovich was a Lubavitcher city, was a Chabad city. Why they had a Litvish Rav is a fascinating story unto itself, but it goes back to the tradition that the Pa'at HaShulchan, the Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, who was Rav of Haslovich at the time of the Napoleonic Wars, and the French troops were looking for the first Lubavitcher Rebbe with an order to execute him, because the first Lubavitcher Rebbe wanted Russia to win the war, not France. And he just didn't want, but he took an active part. One of his Hasidim, Rav Moshe Meislich, who knew French and Russian and German, was a spy and actually related what the French were thinking and going back from camp to camp, revealing what was happening, and the French knew this. And there was a death warrant on the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he hid in the home of the Litvisher Rav of Haslovich. And tradition has it, when the French came looking for him, in every house they searched all over. When they opened the door and the Rav of Haslovich answered, he said, "The Lubavitcher Rebbe, I hate him, I detest him, he's a chassid. If I would find him, I'd give him to you gladly. I'd surrender him, execute him, he's an apitoris. But I don't have him." And the French troops knew, the Litvisher Rav speaks like this, he's right. They were educated people. These were officers, French officers. They understood. They said, "Fine, Rabbi, we're not going to search your house. We know he's not here. He saved the life of the Alter Rebbe." Therefore, they made a vow in Haslovich. They would always have a Rav from the Volozhin family, from that type of school of thought, and preferably from the family. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik becomes Rav in Haslovich, and it was a Chabad town. So yes, it's true. Haslovich is where the Rav gained Shasim Poskim Brisk. It's where the Rav gained his love of Hasidut, his understanding of Hasidut, and particularly his knowledge of Chabad theology of Tanya and Likutei Torah. And all of us know how much the Rav would say he owes to his Chabad Rebbeim, who taught him in Cheder and opened a new world of thought and insight and Hashkafa philosophy, theology, and sermonics and dashanut to him. And the Rav would not be the Rav without this experience in Haslovich. This is what made him different than other Rosh Yeshiva. Beyond the Shakla V'tayi of the Gemara, beyond the Derech Rav Chaim, he was the Rav. It was a whole world beyond. It's all the result of Haslovich. But there's more to Haslovich. World War I
caught them in Germany. And this is a very important point to understand subsequent Torah history. Not many people mention this. We always criticize the Jews for not leaving, not going Aliyah, and not sensing what was about to happen. All right, there's room to be critical. It's not time for today's lecture, and it's not in today's lecture. It's nothing to do with this topic. But what has to do with this is that when the German troops came in, when they saw the Germans fighting, the Jews were overwhelmed with the decency of the German soldiers of World War I. They saw barbarians, they saw Russian troops, they saw Polish troops. These people were barbarians, anti-Semites, pogroms. All of you know the way they sharpened their swords and practiced on whom they practiced. The German soldiers, absolute gentlemen, cultured, respectful, no anti-Semitism. This is World War I. This is why later in life, the Rav can go to Berlin, the Rav is attracted to Berlin, the Rav is at home in Berlin. He refers to Berlin as the seven good years, paraphrasing Yosef's dream. And this is why Jews could never believe that the Germans of World War II would be so cruel. When you read the memoir literature, time and again, people will state, we were happy to see the German troops because we knew they would not be like the Poles, not be like the Russians. We have wonderful memories of World War I, how they rededicated the synagogues, allowed yeshiva under their conquest to function, respected the Rabbanim of Rashi Yeshiva, had military chaplains, world-famous people. Rabbi Dr. Joseph Kalbach was a full colonel in the Russian army, the German army. Rabbi Dr. Leopold Rosnack was a lieutenant colonel in the German army. And this is why they felt no harm would befall them. This is one of the reasons they did not run, they did not flee, they did not leave. They fought the Germans better than the Russians, better than the Poles. And this is the rub. Now you start to understand, after World War I, why Berlin beckoned, why would the whole world before him, he chose later to go in 1926 to study, to conquer the secular world, to achieve ultimately his doctorate. He goes to Berlin, Germany. It's a fascinating point. This is another aspect of Chaslavich and World War and World War I. And finally, and most important, when the Rav came to Chaslavich, most of the Jews in town, if not 100%, 99%, 98%, were not Mechalel Shabbos. The Rav said the only Jews, we have this in our work on the Rav documented, the only Jews who were Mechalel Shabbos. You remember what the Rav said? The doctor and the pharmacist. They were the only ones that were Mechalel Shabbos. And they were enlightened. People had degrees. They weren't from. And the Rav said the doctor was not a doctor. The pharmacist was not a pharmacist. They didn't know too much. There were the only ones who were Mechalel Shabbos. By the end of World War I, in the aftermath of World War I, the Torah Jew was in an absolute minority. You barely found the youngster under 31 who was Shomer Shabbos. Chaslavich, read Shulamit Meisselman's memoir, but it's not only there, it's all over Europe. The Jews were engulfed by all the isms. Anarchism. Socialism, Bolshevikism, but in Chaslavich, communism. A child turned on parents, parents turned on grandparents. It's a new order, it's a new world. The Soviet world, no more wars, no more boundaries, no more borders. International Soviet person, workers of the world unite. Who owns the world? Who owns the money? Who creates the produce? The laborer. He has to own, he has to share the profits. What is this? Rich people become rich off the hard work of the masses? And these ideas were so attractive. This is a world in dissolution, a world in destruction, a world that is changing, a world in context, a world in transformation. And here's the Rav. Here's the Rav. These are the most formative years. So here he is in Chaslavich. And when he came in, everyone was Shomer Shabbos, except for one doctor and one pharmacist. And by 7 years later, when they leave, the shuls are closed. One shul is left open. People risk their lives to go to shul on Yom Kippur. The NKVD and their Jewish division is writing down which Jew is still foolish enough to believe in God, to believe in rituals, religion. What did Karl Marx say? The opium of the masses. This is what divides. This is what destroys us. This is what causes conflict. This is what divides among people. And how foolish can a modern person be to believe in antiquated, ancient ideas that have no relevancy today? And the Jewish masses were caught up with the communist dream. They marched to its tune. They danced to its tune. Sons and daughters of Rabbanim of Gedolei Yisrael, students who themselves had studied in the finest and greatest yeshiva in Lithuania, Slobodka and Novodik and Mir and Rotten, students in Telz, students who had studied with Gedolei Yisrael, students that had a direct link to the Lashon, and these students were marching to the communist tune, Chilul Shabbos, no religion, the whole beautiful concept in their minds, a world without barriers, a world without differences, a world where everybody is equal, a world where wealth is shared, a world where there are no poor, get rid of religion and let us accomplish this great dream. So that the years in Chaslavich have great influence. These are the formative years of the Rav's life. The Rav would not be the Rav today if not for those years. He brisk Voloshin, his father, Hasidus, Semantics, philosophy, Dashanet, call it what you wish, Pashanet Hamikra, it's all a result of those formative years. But more than that, it's an overture why the Rav can go to Germany and why Berlin was so attractive, why the Jews looked up to him, why the most intelligent Jews, the Rav, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, Nechama Leibovich, Avram Yoshua Heschel. You can go on and on. Professor Avram Yoshua Heschel, the Kapishtin's Rebbe's son, the Kapishtin's Rebbe's brother, later at the seminary. Where did he go, if not to Berlin? And one name after another of the greatest minds of East Europe. And look where they found themselves. And it's an enigma. This is Berlin, but this is Berlin at that time. And when you read the memoir literature, you're overwhelmed. They rejoice. The Germans say, and not the Russians, not the Poles. And then you can understand the Rav's fear of communism. Time and again, how the Rav felt how precious America is, how great Western civilization is, democracy, the American democracy, and how he had this fear which reflected in his lectures and his thinking and in his Zionist pronouncements, this fear of communism, because he saw what it did to his hometown. He saw what it did to Chaslavich. He saw the difference from 1913 when he arrived, the youngster, to when he left, a teenager with a fabulous mind in 1920. Let me reiterate, this is the first in a series of 6 lectures which we're devoting and trying to be as honest as possible, as I said an hour and a half ago, not to make the mistake of creating the Rav in our image, but trying to understand the Rav as he was, and perhaps afterwards we can recreate ourselves in his image, Be'ezrat Hashem. We talk about the Rav and Zionism, we talk about Zionism in general. We must always be guided by the Rambam and Hilchot Malachim, Perek Yud Bet Halacha Bet. That Rambam says it all. No one can describe what's going to happen. When you live it, you will experience it. This is a very important factor in understanding the Rav, and I'll come back to it in a later lecture. We spoke about the background of enlightenment. We spoke in terms of Western Europe and Eastern Europe. There's no question that enlightenment in Western Europe led to assimilation and intermarriage.
It led to tragedy upon tragedy for the Jewish people, a tragedy that continues until this very moment. If nowadays Reform and Conservative rabbis can perform marriages for homosexual couples, lesbian couples, it's a result of the breakdown in Jewish life 200 plus years ago, 250 years ago, as we left the ghetto in Western Europe. The ideas reach Eastern Europe, they come across the boundaries, but in Eastern Europe, the ideas take on a more positive Jewish tinge, even where they leave religion and become enlightened and fight with Hasidim, but at least they write in Hebrew, they think in Hebrew, resuscitate Hebrew, and ultimately it leads to the Zionist movement. Now, the Zionist movement is a tremendous problem for us, a problem that lasts until today. Here we have a movement that the success is given to Theodor Herzl, who was Theodor Herzl until the moment he became Benjamin Zev Herzl, and from assimilation he comes to Zionism, but it's a pragmatic Zionism, a political Zionism. It's not a Zionism rooted in Torah. He dies young, 1904, 44 years of age. The world mourns him, the Jewish world mourns him. Perhaps had he lived longer, he would have followed the path of Nathan Birnbaum, but that's perhaps, as they say, if is the biggest word in the dictionary. What's fascinating is the Rav's forebears. You go to Voloshin, you go to where Rabbi Soloveitchik was nurtured, where his roots are. You look at one Elder Zeder, the Netziv, Rav Heschel Leib, and you have a precursor of the Zionist movement with all that that implies, someone who read Haskalah literature, the great Rosh Yeshiva, but open to what was happening around him and interacting, writing and answering and critiquing to those around him. You go to Reb Chaim and Reb Yosef Be'er, you have a total negation of modernity, even of Agudat Yisrael. The story of the Hesped for the Briska in Brisk for Herzl is classic, but that reflects Reb Chaim's attitude. The story that I bring down in the Rav, where Reb Chaim says to Reb Nachman Krakowski, give me the names of the Mizrachiites. He refuses. I made an oath. Nishba al Masha Katov Batorah. And your oath has no validity whatsoever. But remember, with it all, the love that a Torah Jew has, Reb Chaim, Seydin, Zakin, and Nashim is not just Reb Chaim, but his maybe his greatest achievements. He resuscitated Zrayim, Kodshim, Tara, Techidushim. Unbelievable what Reb Chaim did there. And that's Eretz Yisrael. Haslovich, the Rav's formative years, yes, he came in. 99% was Shomer Shabbos. He left. You could barely find a youngster under 31, 39 years of age who was Shomer Shabbos. The attitude towards Germany, the German soldier, it's an overture for the future. But above all, the communist takeover, the communist brainwashing, and the youth that took on communism, embraced it, yeshiva boys, men, women. Look at Shalom Aleichem. Look at Fiddler on the Roof. Look at the daughter who marries the Gentile. Look at the daughter who marries the Jewish revolutionary. That was a story based upon facts of life. And the Rav saw all this in Haslovich. This sets the stage for the next moment in the Rav's life, Warsaw. Be'ezrat Hashem, next time we meet, we turn to Warsaw. Thank you very much.